Hi, you're listening to a podcast of the best bits of Breakfasters with Mon, Bron and Daniel for this week, ending Friday the 5th of June. You can hear us live on Triple R every weekday morning from 6 to 9 a.m, broadcast on Wurundjeri Country, Australia. Coming up on the pod this week, to celebrate its 20th anniversary, Alice Pung's memoir Unpolished Gem is getting a reissue, and the award-winning author joined us in studio to reflect on its journey and also how many times she's had knits. And we reminisce on the long-lost era of Rocker Steadford.
Flickford joined us to review Spanish film Deaf, or Sorta, whichever your preference, and star of The Crown and The Kite Runner, Khalid Abdullah, dropped in to chat about his deeply personal stage show, Nowhere.
We learn about letting it all hang out in Sweden, and book reviewer Sean O'Byrne bangs the drum for Halle Butler's satire, Banal Nightmare. Triple R. Alice Pung is the best-selling author of her memoir, Her Father's Daughter, and the collection of essays Close to Home, as well as novels Lorinda, which won the Ethel Turner Prize at the New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards, and 100 Days, which was shortlisted for the Miles Franklin. Published in 2006, her globally renowned debut, Unpolished Gem, has been re-released via Black Ink with a special 20th anniversary edition. To tell us about it, the word spreader and self-described Bogan Asian from Braybrook joins us now. Alice, welcome to Breakfasters.
Oh, thanks so much, Daniel.
Now, how do you conceive of this book now? Is it, when was the last time you reread it? Was there a couple of decades there where you didn't reread?
Oh, there was, Daniel. Yeah, there was about 10 years when I didn't reread it, only because it had been put on curriculum around Australia and some other countries like Singapore and the state of Texas, a stranger. some schools there. But I had to reread it recently, just to write the afterword, and I was really anxious. I thought, oh, it's got to be so cringy. but because I'm reading two decades later, you know, I was able to, and I've got a family, I've got three kids of my own, I was able to be kinder to my young self and thought, this is okay for a 20-year-old.
Nice.
Yeah.
Do you think did it make you look at your own children in a fresh light, being reminded of your own youth and reflecting on your grandmother's youth and mother's youth as well?
Oh, I guess it did. And it also made me reflect, Daniel, on it was a very different time 20 years ago. And when you're writing, you're not aware of politics and you're not aware of the things that are happening around you. I was aware the very first sentence is, this story does not begin on a boat. Because that was a time when our government was, you know, very unkind to boats coming into Australia. And I think it was deliberate. I wanted people to know this is not a refugee story. We flew here on a plane and, you know, it was tongue-in-cheek. But it was also quite deliberate, yeah.
There's also a bit of gratitude, which is weirdly refreshing in this climate. Your family is so expressive and articulate about the positives of life and looking for small, shining, you know, examples and mercies.
Oh, like traffic lights, because they've never had traffic lights before in Cambodia and other things, you know, even social security, which old people didn't get in Cambodia. I was driving here and I was thinking, even politicians, because they don't get paid. You know, you've got business people and even school principals who get paid more than politicians who get a lot of flack in the media. So, you know, there was this enormous gratitude by my parents, and there still is, for a functional democracy, which we have. Mm. We have in Australia. Some countries don't have that.
Like father government, is that what that was referred to in the memoir? Notion of father government?
Yeah. Yeah, so my grandmother referred to the government as father government. So when I was young, I thought he was like a Father Christmas character with a bag of checks slung over his back. You
know? With the appliance store in Footscray, are there literary tourists who wander in saying, are you Alice's mum and dad?
Oh, Daniel, there were at the start. And it's still it's still there. It's no longer Retrovision. It's a better electrical store. And the people who are, my parents are still there. Average age of 70. You know, they're really old. But when the book first came out, you know, I used to work at the store, and my father used to have a shoplifters alert whenever you saw young people with their backpacks. And one day, there was a huge group of them, about 14 or 15 with backpacks. And my dad thought, oh, no, this is a concentrated effort to steal small things. And then this woman who was with these young people came up to her and said, oh, you know, I'm a teacher from a school across the other side of the river. And my dad was really pleased that schools from the other side of the river and not from the western suburbs were doing these tours of the rough, you know, rough western suburbs. And some of the schools would email me, and one teacher said, should our kids bring bum bags, you know, that you wear around your waist? Because they were scared of the kids getting robbed. And
no.
Yeah, no. It was a genuine question. I think backpacks should be okay.
You're wrong.
Yeah.
No, get those money, but the one you put under your shirt.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That you wear to Southeast Asia, yeah. Not to Footscray.
What about the path that it set you on, and the choices that you've made, the amount of school visits and teaching that you've done as well, and maybe how it relates to, of course, your famous On Writers essay on John Marsden as well?
Oh, thanks for that question, Daniel, because it's one of the greatest joys of what came out of this book. It's not the writers' festivals or the awards, although the ones attached to money have been quite good. But it's the school visits, and I recently wrote to my agents, and they said, you've done 650 school visits over the past decade or so, you know, over the past year. So, and that's a phenomenal figure that I didn't even know, because it's been such a joy to visit schools. School kids are the same everywhere, whether they're from Alaska or Singapore or from Wangaratta or Wagga Wagga. And they're all grappling with very similar things. And I think my late friend John Marsden put it really well. He wrote very gritty books about being a young person, some of which were banned in school libraries when I was a young person. But, you know, these days parents want their kids to be happy, and they can't endure any suffering for their kids. But we need to feel the full spectrum of emotions and let our children feel the same as well. They need to suffer a little bit and fail a little. Yeah.
How does that come through in your parenting, with allowing children to suffer, as you put it?
This is quite personal, but when my son was 10 weeks old, my brother passed away, so I... because he was and he's in the book, so that's another reason I haven't looked over the book in a decade, because it's just too painful. But, you know, he was the only son in our family, so my sisters and I were quite young at that time. We're responsible for organising this funeral with a 10-week-old, and I resolved to myself that, you know, we would get through this, and my children would be able to deal with things like this, you know. And a lot of immigrant children, even now, the children I mentor, you know, teenagers or even primary school kids who are even grappling with vaping in primary school because their parents are working all the time, or, you know, violence. One of the young people said to me recently, he said, Miss, I just don't like the fact that we're African gangs. I'm not a gangster. I go home, I look after my younger sisters. And I said, oh, look, don't worry, Ahmed. We were the same. And he looked at me, and he didn't believe me, because to him we are K-pop demon hunters. He didn't understand that 2 decades ago we were the gangsters. We were the people who brought heroin into this country. So from a young age, we understood what it was like to be maligned, and also what it was like to deal with adult situations in unpolished gem. You know, I'm translating for my parents when I'm 9 or 10, and life insurance policies, you know, getting on the phone with Telecom, as it was known back then, and trying to sort things out for my mum. So young people aren't innocent unless they're quite privileged to be protected from everyday life.
How's your knits game these days?
Oh, the knits game. Oh, I'm so ashamed of this, but I've had knits 4 times in the past year or so, just because I've got 3 kids. So the knits game is still, it is a battle I haven't won yet.
My grandma used to douse us in kerosene.
Oh.
We'd sit out in the sun, comb kerosene through our hair.
That's quite dangerous. It's flammable.
I think so, yeah.
Oh, that's right.
But never works. Yeah.
Did you get teased or anything or not?
No.
Everyone was kerosene, were they?
No. I didn't go to school and tell everyone. Oh. It was just like out in the backyard at her place in the sun. Homing kerosene through her hair. I had a shower before I went to school the next day.
Oh, wow.
I more just got teased for having red hair. So that was already happening.
Oh, Bronwyn, my husband has red hair.
She understands your plight.
Did he get called a freckle fart from Kmart?
I remember my best friend Rebecca.
I've never heard that.
I feel your pain. But I wanted our kids to be ginger ninjas. I'm like, if they had red hair and they were Asian, that's like a double whammy. Yeah.
Did you get a perm?
Yes.
Yeah,
I
right.
did, because like Bronwyn's mum, my mum thought it would kill off all the head lice, you know, the perm chemicals, and if it not the chemicals, then the heat. And she paid $25 for it from Yvonne, the backyard hairdresser in the garage. And I cried, and she yelled at me for crying. She said, no other kid has a $25, you know, hairstyle. So she was doing her best.
I love that. When you read Unpolished Gem, are you struck by the continuity as well? Like, oh, I am, there I am. I do recognise it. That does feel like a continuation of me.
Oh, I don't know, Daniel. I know the store continues, so that's the most enduring thing, this electrical appliance store. I hope to think I'm two decades older and have some wisdom, but it does sound like a young version of me, and the version of me now has a lot of stuff on top of that I, you know, hopefully learn over the years.
Yeah, but it's still recognisable. You, and, you know, you mentioned in the afterword that you were considering writing under a pseudonym. I suppose you don't regret doing that.
Oh, no, I don't regret using my real name after all, yeah.
God, can you just tell us about the relationship with your publisher and how meaningful and special that is?
Oh, yeah, because I've been with my publisher for 20 years only because I've been with this wonderful editor named Chris Fike. When he was beginning as an editor, I was beginning as a young writer, and he read a short story I wrote in Mianjin, and he gave me a call out of the blue and said, oh, I liked your story. Is it part of a book? And back then I didn't know how to write a proper short story, so it probably ended up sounding like a chapter of the book because it was unfinished. I had no chapters. I had just this one short story, but I thought, this is my only chance. And Eminem was going through my mind, you got this one chance. And I said, yes, it's a chapter of a book. Can I show you more? And so that's how I came to be published with Chris and Black Ink. So it's been two decades.
Nice.
Yeah.
And are there any events associated with the book that we can look forward to?
Oh, yes. Yeah, so next Wednesday I'll be giving a talk at the Fitzroy Library. And then on the 22nd of July, Footscray Library, which is where I wrote some of the book, are kind enough to have this big launch for me.
Wow.
Yeah.
They have a plaque there on the table where you were.
Oh, have a plaque.
Just chewing gum and graffiti underneath.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yes, a plaque made of chewing gum.
Well, we've been fortunate to be joined by Alice Pung, whose 20-year anniversary of Unpolished Gem is out now via Black Ink. We've wanted to get you in the studio for so long, and we're appreciative that you can afford the time with us this morning. Thanks, Alice.
Thank you so much.
Melbourne's own Triple R.
Were either of you Rocker Steadford kids?
Was not.
You weren't?
No.
No? Neither. Mm. I never got to do it. And honestly, if I had my time again, still wouldn't do it.
Mm.
But I do love hearing Rocker Steadford stories. They're kind of like war stories almost. But I mean, it wrapped up in like 2012, which is...
Oh, did it?
Yeah, it doesn't... It's done.
Okay.
But I mean...
Maybe there's a new school spectacular.
There is something, because I worked for a production company that used to, like, put it on the air. But I think it was something different. They'd rebranded it. We lost the word Steadford.
I like having them equate to war stories, though. Bring some razzle-dazzle to the last post.
It's a remix. I'll go down... A lot of them are on YouTube.
Oh.
And I'll go down that...
like rabbit hole a bit.
Who's recording them?
Well, they used to be on TV.
Yeah, used to be on TV.
So there's one that went viral a little while ago, which is a school that did the big thing. They always have a big theme they take on, and this one was the seven deadly sins, and they did it as The Simpsons.
Oh, and it's just really yes, I have seen clips of this.
Yeah, it's insane, and the interview is pretty funny. Oh, they're just big dorks that are like, I don't think parents understand what is happening in these cartoons. Which it is fun because it started out as like an anti-smoking, anti-drug campaign for kids, and it's like, I don't think these
the
are the
Rocky Stenford did.
Yeah, these aren't the kids you need to worry about.
Like, put down the ciggy, come do some
tap.
Yeah,
come do some dance. Yeah. There's a reason they got so much time to learn this choreo. They're not invited to parties.
It's all leading to Steadman just squashing a durry.
It's like Terry, you're like in Greece where she like flicks a cigarette down and steps on it.
Tell me about it, Steph. Yeah.
That's when she gave up smoking and chose the life of dance.
And then flew off in a car. No, Liz did it. She got to be they did Blow Up the Pokies by the Whitlams, and she was a pokey machine. Which, when you are trying to tell a story through movement, what you want to be is a box.
But is she getting blown up?
She got dragged away. But I heard a particularly good one over the weekend. I loved this so much. So I was chatting to a guy, and he did Rocker Steadford when he was in high school, and he was saying that obviously they always like take on a theme, a big topic, and he said they were getting ready for Rocker Steadford, and his teacher came in and was so excited and was like, "We've got a great theme this year. Like, this is we're going to win it. This is our year. What we're going to do? Get ready, kids. We're going to do the Bali bombing."
Oh, gee.
You ever look back at high school and you think, God, how did we get left alone with that person?
Yeah, he was in charge.
Yeah. Wait. That person, he was in charge. Well, it would have been early 2000s.
As in this, so like it was fresh.
Fresh.
Wow.
Fresh off the back. The song they had to sing and dance to was Fields of Gold by Sting. Famously has the line, "Upon the fields of barley."
But it's
with different Bali. Yeah. This guy was like, I was a kid and I knew this wasn't good. He's just running around going, singing about the fields of Bali. He's like, oh, this isn't right.
Because there was a concert. There was a quite beautiful concert, wasn't there?
Like a fundraiser.
Yeah, I remember, I think Bernard Fanning maybe played These Days.
Yeah.
But it sounds like the Eastern.
I'm sure it would have been handled in a much more sensitive way by amateur dance through 15-year-olds
to reenact the trauma in dance.
Yeah, through dance. Wow. Healing through dance. Oh. What a song.
Well, they saw Pokey Reform, so I don't see why they
said that's true.
Yeah, way to bring a country together. Maybe that's what Trump needs for Freedom 250, a bit of Rocker Steadford.
That's it, yeah.
So did this happen?
Yeah, did they? So it wasn't just the teacher's idea. They went through and that was their entry.
They went through, yeah, that was their entry.
That is awful.
Horrendous. He's scarred from it.
I would be too, but when you're a kid, you're just like, well, I guess this teacher is just so edgy.
Well, it's all, I mean, you look at Sweeney Todd, they're all a bit nuts.
Yeah, I think it would have been maybe 2 years after it happened.
Yeah, it would have been pretty fresh.
Yeah. And also just like, look up how the lyrics are spelt.
Why would look up anything about this? Do you think they just like had the idea? They're like, oh my God. Just like a lightning bolt of inspiration, like fields of barley.
That's what stings. And when I go to Bali, I do love hanging out in the field.
Yeah.
That's what you go to Bali for.
Was there a special like homophone category or something?
Oh, someone's just texting to say they did the Holocaust
for Rocker Steadford. To be fair, the text just says we did the Holocaust.
Oh, do you think this is No, Nazi Germany phoning in.
You did it for the... Wow. Okay. That is crazy. Who is keeping tabs on these teachers and their ideas?
Like, they should have had to run it past someone.
Well, the amount of bureaucracy is what we're doing. You have to put up with as a teacher, especially at a state school. I just can't believe that when it comes to the Estedford, it's just no matter what you do, whatever you like.
People are... No,
as long as you've got those jazz hands.
Do you think people don't
want
to deal with the music and drama teachers? They're like, let them go.
Yeah, just let them rip.
Yeah.
Let them cook. Wow.
The ambitions.
Well, they're getting kids
impressive.
Off the drugs, so...
And yes, like it does. Mr. G was.
It has got a bit of Mr. G energy, yeah.
Yeah, getting on TV would be a thrill. And someone did say it is the Victorian State School Spectacular at John Cain Arena, and it's aired on commercial TV, so that must have been.
Oh, so it's still good. So
why would we
still...
get rid of calling it the Estedford? And tell me, well, when else will we get to use that word?
I think because it was a national thing. So now that's in the bin. So now Victoria must have its own.
Oh,
state.
And did it just used to be state schools? Because I had a couple of cousins who did it, and I'm pretty sure they went to a Catholic school.
This is a state of origin I could get behind.
You reckon? Yeah, bring me a stead for
state by state.
Totally. I mean, what are you, the Holocaust versus the Bondi massacre? Jesus.
Who can dance better to that?
What is going on out there?
Independent Melbourne Radio 3RRR.
Well, you can't help but be all ears when Flick Ford's in the studio. Morning, Flick.
Hello, how perfect. Wonderful segue to the title of our film that we're going to be discussing, Deaf, the Spanish title Sorda. Now, this is an award-winning Spanish film written and directed by Eva Libertad, and it's something of a continuation of her 2023 short film by the same name. And I opened with the Spanish title, but it has been released here on streaming as Deaf. And I've been trying to track down its release in Australia. It seems as though it played at a few film festivals, maybe a handful of special events, but I don't think it had widespread cinematic release. And I'm happy to be corrected on the text line if I'm wrong on that. But I'm really glad I've got an opportunity to spotlight it this morning. I rented it on Apple TV, but it seems like it's available to rent or buy from a few other platforms as well. So, Sorda is about Angela, a deaf woman living this rather idyllic life in rural Spain. She works at a pottery studio and swims in these very beautiful lakes with her attentive partner Hector in her time off. And the couple are expecting their first baby, and the pregnancy stirs up anxieties and shame around disability and disconnection, with lots of questions of whether the baby will hear like Hector or be deaf like Angela. And Angela is played by Libertad, the director's sister, Libertad's sister, Miriam Gallo, who is herself deaf. And her performance is absolutely enthralling. There's a lot of talk about the importance of lived experience in casting both behind and in front of the camera. And this is such a beautiful and brilliant example of what can be achieved when you properly center authentic storytelling, authentic experience, and allow for this to be a really active collaborative element in your storytelling. And there's such a enigmatic fire to Gallo's performance, and the camera is so often trained on her in like a medium or a close-up shot to capture her response to different things that are happening. And sometimes it's like this really simple micro gesture on her face that could so easily be missed in kind of like a buzz of conversation or lunch, you know, with lunch with friends. But the camera and in turn the audience are granted this access to the reaction, and therefore we follow this experience of her telling her parents about the pregnancy and getting this really lukewarm reaction of having tests to see whether the baby will be deaf or hearing, seeing her partner, Hector, move with ease and confidence through the world as a hearing person, and the very real identity crisis that happens when you first become a parent. And the relationship at the centre between Angela and Hector is so beautifully evoked, and there's this palpable connection between them. Hector is played by Alvaro Cervantes, and like Carlos, he was also nominated and awarded for his performance. And it felt like a very authentic representation of a loving but also very deeply complex relationship. There's this tenderness and playfulness when they're choosing baby names or they're floating in the water together or hosting friends. And there's also a real sexual spark and erotic charge between them, which I think makes it all the more heartbreaking when the baby arrives and, of course, their lives and their relationship are put under so much strain. And it's not simply that, it's not just the baby. I think it's more so the expectations and the stories that we tell ourselves both individually and as a society around deafness and disability more broadly. And I think there's this sharply felt pain of seeing Hector and her parents talk and play with the baby in a way that is so different to how Angela herself communicates. And also the interaction she sees between her fellow deaf friends and their children, and some of whom are hearing. There's lots of scenes that are communicated entirely in sign. And I think for me, that was so interesting, seeing a really detailed celebration, exploration of the deaf community, and kind of you really got a sense of the joy of finding connection in a community of friends who really understand your experience. And I think that unlike so many on-screen representations of disability, Angela doesn't fall into any of the tropes of being like inspirational or redemptive or some sage guiding us through the story. She's very messy, she's fallible, she's passionate and sometimes quite selfish. And I think to be a selfish mother is something of a taboo on screen. Well, in real life, but on screen, we don't see it. We see it handled in such a different way to how we present on-screen fathers who can be completely absent or work late into the evenings. And I think there's even a glorification of that. And so that tension between, in, say, a straight relationship, that tension in parenthood is so beautifully or painfully evoked. And I think that for me just it just felt so real, and I was so affected by this film on lots of levels. I have a disability. My younger brother has a severe intellectual disability, and I think that so many times I do have an issue with the title, because I think that if they had gone with the Spanish title of Sorda, there would have been an element of perhaps bringing in an audience that may not have Googled what Sorda means and have come seen the film, because I think people will see deaf, feel as though that's not my experience. And I think that siloing is such a danger in all sorts of representation, because if disability doesn't affect you now, it will in some way. And, you know, it's something that it's so easy to sort of pigeonhole it as a special category. But, you know, Angela and actually Carlos, who plays Angela, both were able-bodied at birth and were deaf when they developed deafness. And I think that, you know, you can be born able-bodied, you can be born disabled, and there's so many questions like, Mona, you know, you've gone through this with all the tests and things like that when you're having a baby. And the way that medical professionals sometimes talk about disability as though it's something to be this huge risk and this danger, without thinking that disability actually is never the issue. It's a society that doesn't create spaces for it and doesn't allow for it. So I think that it'd be great if more medical professionals would see this film. I think all parents should see this film, because there's so much beauty. And seeing her parents, who are now grandparents, engage, and the different kind of parenting that you see, I thought that was just really, really interesting to see on screen. But, yeah, I just feel as though I really hope that the title of Deaf, which has been released in Australia, doesn't put people off, because I just think so much about how it will impact us. It could be through an accident, it could be a temporary disability, it could be a long-term disability, it could be your parents that you have to care for, your partner. Like, there's so many ways in which disability impacts us all. And I just think this is such a beautiful film. It's quite short and contained. The performances are exceptional. It's beautifully shot. It's very emotional, and I really loved that it has so much grounding in reality, and it's a perfect film in my opinion.
Wow.
And I hope more people see it.
It sounds like it's more a film about relationships and family than parenting.
Yeah, there's different elements. Yes.
Sorry, not then parenting, then deafness, I meant to say.
Ah, yeah. Well, the deafness is a big element in the sense of that intersection of all those things with the identity of deafness.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that that disconnect that can happen in the sense of how you see yourself. Do you see yourself as a member of the deaf community?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you see yourself as a mother? Or do you see, you know, like how... And, that kind of splintering of self is so universal for lots of parents, particularly the childbearing parent. And I thought that was just such a, it's a very honest, I have to maybe content advice. There is a very real scene of birth. Well, not real, I shouldn't say that. It feels very realistic. Very realistic. Okay. And I think...
seen it.
We talked about watching birth scenes. It's 6:15, so we're all across.
Yes, so we're back there. And I think that just navigating that space as a deaf person, I think that's really well communicated. Also, I should mention there's a wonderful creative device in which they bring us into the experience of what it is for Angela to live with deafness. And there's, I think that it uses it in a really key scene, and it's so impactful. And I actually found that really fascinating, and you can just see how cinema can be a perfect vehicle for empathy, for building connection, and a deeper understanding of experiences outside of our own. And I go see it.
Wow.
Okay. Stream it immediately. Rent it. Buy it.
Yeah. Yes. Right.
And it's searchable by Sorda or Deaf.
Yeah. I found it on Apple TV, but I'm not.
I don't
have any preference with streaming.
And the director again?
Eva Libertad. So she hasn't made a tremendous number of films, but this she has got a short film, as I mentioned, that is this is where it started.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. All right. Thanks for putting that on our radar.
My pleasure. Yeah.
Deaf, we've been talking about, or Sorda. Good on you. Are we seeing you soon? Next week?
Yes. I'll be on air Monday.
Love it.
Independently yours, Triple R.
102.7.
Khalid Abdallah is an actor, writer and activist whose screen credits include The Kite Runner, which was nominated for Best Foreign Language Film at the Golden Globes and BAFTAs, The Crown, which saw him receive a Critics' Choice Television Award nomination for Best Supporting Actor in a Drama Series, and the documentary The Square about the 2011 Egyptian Revolution, and which won the Audience Award at Sundance. The creator is in town for Rising with his solo show Nowhere, which made its premiere at Sydney Festival, and to tell us about it, the multifaceted artist joins us now. Khalid, welcome to Breakfasters.
Thank you for having me.
Persevering through jet lag, no doubt.
Absolutely.
So does that mean you went to Sydney, then went away and have come back?
More than that. I went to Sydney, went away, came to Aotearoa, New Zealand, then came back, and now this is my third time over.
Goodness gracious. Now, tell us about this show. And it doesn't seem like we're in the unenviable position of having not seen it yet.
Yeah.
Because opening night is when?
Tomorrow.
Amazing. Oh, God. So, I can't imagine many actors have bitten off such a creative endeavour, and we want to know all about this show.
Well, it's called Nowhere for a reason, which maybe we'll kind of get to. And it started as a kind of, in terms of processing my experience of revolution in Egypt. But through the prism of that, it explores the kind of world of crises that we're living in and enters into colonial histories and family histories and then returns to the present through Palestine and the genocide. But as a theatrical show and a spectacle that has the kind of highs and lows of both the humour and, you know, and kind of deep emotionality. It's my attempt to speak to this moment and also create a space. Because that's one of the kind of fundamental things about it, why it's called Nowhere. I mean, the title originally came... So I was living in Egypt from 2008 to 16 and returned literally the day after the Brexit vote. Mm-hmm. And around that time, Theresa May gave a speech in which she said, "And if you believe you're a citizen of the world, you're a citizen of nowhere." and that hurt. But at the time, so Kate McGraw, who is the producer of the show, she had asked me a few years prior if I had a play in me, because she'd been following my participation in Egypt and the revolution. And I come from a family of political prisoners, both my father and grandfather were political prisoners on the left in Egypt. And she asked me if I had a play in me, and I said, maybe, but not now. And, you know, and then I had that rerouting in London, Brexit, etc. And then it was COVID, and then George Floyd was murdered, at which point my body just kind of erupted in the sense of, if not now, when?
Mm.
And you know, in a sense, you track that time and you keep going, and then you get to a moment in which the most resonant words around nowhere are nowhere is safe.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The play is kind of resonating around all of that, and of course in relation to Palestine we all have all grown up with the silences around it, and so how do you create a space in which to gather? And that's one of the very important things for me, which also as well comes out of the revolutionary experience, because you know, in living through revolution, you know, the weeks before it erupts everyone says, no, this will never happen. And then millions of people are out on the street realigning themselves into the possibility of a different kind of future. And then inevitably comes the counter-revolution, and everyone is pushed back into the shadows and prison. And I have very many friends and so on. But nonetheless, what had happened still is in your body and exists. And so again, to create a space in which that sense of possibility can gather and which is safe, in which to dream around these things, talk about them, acknowledge them. Which is one of the reasons as well where, I mean, you know, performing on this side of the world, which is now happening now for the third time, has really meant a lot to me. And although there's a very long way to go, but this part of the world is attempting to reconcile with these colonial histories. As I understand it, we're in National Reconciliation Week. Right. That is not happening in the UK. That is not happening on other parts of the world, you know. So you create a space in which this can happen.
What informs your taste for spectacle and theatricality, as you describe it, to get all of this and grapple with it and make it entertaining in a way that excites you?
Gosh. Well, I mean, the first thing is not to be boring, right? but this show in particular, it's surprising because it constantly it wrong foots what you think it's going to be, and it includes, you know, I mean, it's got projection in it, and it's got dance in it, and it's got drawing in it, and it's got all sorts of different creative forms, except it's done, I hope, in this show in a way that feels almost kind of handmade, like anyone could do this. Everyone has a personal history, right? Everyone has their own photographs. Everyone has an experience of their body, of what it is to live in this world with microaggressions that come at you in various different ways and where that sits inside you. And in this show, I attempt to kind of journey through that, but as almost as an invitation the whole time. It's hard to explain until you've seen the show.
Yeah,
a lot of these issues are historical and obviously colonial histories, but then some of the atrocities are ongoing, like what's happening in Gaza. Has this performance changed as it's evolved since you've started it?
Yeah, it. I mean, it's been over a year and a half now that I've been performing it, and it's been what now, like almost 5-6 years since I first drafted it.
Right.
And over that time, we've been through one hell of a roller coaster. Mm. I mean, even on my last trip over to New Zealand. You know, I was on one of the last flights out of Dubai before they closed airspace. When I was last here, it was weeks after the Bondi attack. You know, each iteration of the show has, and also every different place that it's performed in, it's now been, I don't know, 10 or so different cities across the world, each has its own different resonance in relation to these histories. And so I always try and bring those out. But the change, but there are also things that remain very much the same. And it's a kind of interesting filtration process. I mean, when I first performed the show in the UK, in London, it was, it was, the word genocide was something that was hard to say in a theatre in terms of the controversy it would bring up. But, you know, now, amongst a lot of people, there is a consensus over that, and the situation changes. And now we're also in a moment in which that genocide is being treated as, okay, we can get beyond that now and forget that it ever happened. These things change the nature of the show, but you know, fundamentally, the injustices remain the same. What's not being acknowledged very often is, in terms of those deep histories, still needs to be talked about. So those things remain at the heart of the show. And it's kind of sad that they don't have to change in a way.
Is this project Nowhere not a sidestep, but is it does it signal a new trajectory, or can we expect to see you on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here?
I mean, I want to keep making my own work as well, which I'm doing, but not quite. I don't know if they invite me. They invite me, I'd be up for it. Well, maybe. I continue to make film work and theatre work, and I'm writing, and I'm, you know, various other collaborative projects on the way.
Does doing a show like this affect invitations or anything like that?
Doing the show has been amazing because of all the ways in which it's just been received everywhere that it's been. I normally get that question in relation to speaking up about Palestine and whether that's had an effect on me. And the general answer I give, because it's true, is that it's mostly been positive for me. It's, you know, widened the circles of solidarity around me and brought an incredible community and various projects and collaborations. But I say that in the context of meeting this world as an Arab actor. When you meet this world as an Arab actor, I exist in a context of a racist gaze towards, you know, and structural racism towards people of my background. So what did I stand to lose in that sense? You know, the people that would have wanted to work with me are still the people that want to work with me. The people that didn't want to work with me or were making shows that I would consider racist in some ways were not ones that I would have done. The structure is for me, it's widened. On the other side, I've also kind of moved into a place where I say it's too early to tell, you know. It's going to take time, I think, for the kind of work that needs to be made over these next 5-10 years that responds to the shift in global consciousness that I think has happened in terms of what that makes in work, you know. And that's exciting. It's a challenge to meet. It's, for me, part of what this show is, but what I hope, you know, the things I do in the future do as well.
Yeah. Gee, it sounds incredible. And also, does Theresa May crack a mention?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's amazing. Who was the extremely short-lived Prime Minister?
Oh, Liz Truss.
Liz Truss.
The Cabot. The lettuce. Yeah, that's right, exactly.
Khalid Abdullah can be seen in Nowhere. It opens tomorrow night as part of Rising. Very exciting. And we're talking the Merlin Theatre at South
Malt House.
At the Malt House, yes. And for goodness sake, you've got to get to the Rising website for tickets right now. And there's going to be a Q&A at one point.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah, which are always great. They're always very special because after the show, it's kind of possible to have a conversation in which everything has been established that needs to be talked about and you can kind of go so much further. Mm-hmm. They're amazing, those conversations.
Yeah, right. God, I bet the organisers have to kick you out because everyone's... Gross.
As you can see, I just talk and talk.
That's why we laugh on radio. Exactly. Khalid Abdallah is the actor, writer and activist who you can catch in Nowhere at the Malthouse Theatre. Head to Rising website, as we say, for more information. Thanks so much, Khalid.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Triple R on FM, digital, online and via the app.
I think it's pretty safe to say that compared to Europeans, I think, Australians, we can be quite prudish.
Prudish?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. They're pretty, like, comfortable with nudity, that kind of thing. Liz went to Sweden a couple of years ago, and she was really determined not to be a prude.
Mm.
And she went to a sauna with a friend, a Swedish friend, and a friend, they went for, it was her friend's birthday, and so Liz paid for her to get a massage. So she went and got a massage, and Liz was going to use the spa sauna. And she's in the change room. There's no one else in there. She's like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to be full Swedish. And she got naked. And then she went through this door that she thought would, like, go to the sauna, but she's sort of in a hallway. And she's like, okay. And there's, like, different rooms going off for, like, different saunas and things. She goes, does her thing. She's, like, going, trying out all the saunas. Her friend Maria finishes her massage, comes back. And she's like, how was it? And this is like, it was great. I've been around using all the rooms. And Maria's like, okay, cool. Well, let's go. We'll go back. Let's do everything you did. And then Maria goes to go into the hallway with her bathers on. And Liz was like, sorry. I was in there naked. And Maria was like, what are you talking about? Like, if you have made a Swede blush, you have been too naked. No. And it is not that kind of sauna. And it's, Maria's like, there's men in here. What are you doing? And she's like, show me everywhere you went. And Liz was like, so I was in this sauna. And she was like, naked? Fully naked. No. So she went around this whole place completely naked. And I was like, were there other people with clothes on? She's like, yes, but I just thought they were tourists and they were losers.
Wow. Oh, my God. When in Rome. Wow. That is amazing. Did it change her mindset where she's like, I can do anything? Like, I've done it now and I wasn't even meant to. Or was she just...
No, she was mortified.
Oh, okay.
So there was like an infrared sauna with like these wooden slat deck chairs. And she was like, that was so uncomfortable to be naked.
So
much. She's like, oh, I was like, did you have a towel, a robe? She's like, nothing. I just went for it.
So where'd she get, just from the popular culture, got the impression that she nude it up?
Yeah, just exactly. So she was like, this is what you do in Sweden and I'm going to do it. And then her friend was like, see that sign in English that says bathers? Wear bathers.
Oh, wow. And I went to a bathhouse in Budapest, I think, and I saw these shorts that I had there in my drawer the other day, and I'm like, I was like, Christ Almighty!
Oh, those short shorts.
Oh yeah, they were short shorts. Oh, I was spinning around. Can't get that bunker with that wedgie out of my head.
Are you just keeping them for aspirational purposes? Like, you're going to get back in those shorts one day?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they're a memento now. I can't throw them out. But yeah, that was the closest. Although I think, I can't remember. I thought there were nude people there, but maybe I'm hallucinating.
When you closed your eyes, you saw them.
Yeah. Well, so
yeah, maybe I just undressed everyone in my mind.
But Liz wanders into places, you know, Liz is a bit of a chancer, it seems.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Mm.
She never will read any instructions, ask any questions, just goes for it. I'm like, what are we doing, though? She's like, this is fine. Even on the weekend.
I can't believe she didn't ask her. She was with a local. She didn't say, hey, just before you go, what's the deal with this sauna?
No, she said, she thought, I'm in Stockholm. Everyone's going to be nude. And I'm going to join in.
And she didn't get weird reactions? That's almost more interesting.
Like, people were trying to be polite.
Yeah, okay.
And they were like, oh! I mean, they just thought she was a local. She has blonde hair, I guess. Yeah. These Swedes are crazy.
I'm trying to think of the Swedish for like Mamma Mia or the Swedish.
I don't know anything. Tak, thank you. That's it. Or is that Danish? Oh, God.
Actually, on the weekend, we were at a friend's house out in the country and there was some mushrooms in their backyard and they looked like pine mushrooms, kind of. And Lisk was like, yeah, 100% they're pine mushrooms.
Oh, my God. Have you learned 100%.
Nothing? 100%. And then, oh, my God, looked it up and I was like, these are poisonous.
Of course they're poisonous. They're in your backyard and you never touch it. I've been having that conversation with my three-year-old recently saying, don't touch a mushroom that you don't find at the supermarket.
She was so confident. I was like, have you ever gone foraging for mushrooms? She's like, no, but that's definitely a pine. I was like, oh, you need to rein it in.
Never eating your risotto.
I know. She's going to, like, be found dead naked and I'm like
I saw it coming.
The wing at the sauna. Are you her wise counsel or are you, it's hard to say. Do you think she's making you less prudish?
She's making me more prudish. Now I'm on like, because you don't know now. I would be everywhere I'd go, I'd be like asking around.
Should I be nude here? Should I be nude? It's a bakery.
Should I be nude here?
Would you be happier if I was nude? And then I have to turn around and go, I told you we're not supposed to be nude here.
Like 100% you should be nude.
Take off those clothes, please.
No, before we get out of the car, I think we should take our clothes off. Like, no,
we are in Sweden. Put that map away and take off your bra.
Don't Google it.
I did go to the springs in Hakone in Japan, and I remember that was a
real... we've all done lots of really impressive stuff.
And when I was backpacking alone, and I thought... But I remember that was a real... Because I'm a never nude.
Yeah.
But I had to embrace that. But I had the whole place to myself. And so I was like, not like... As, but then...
As in you cleared it out.
Yeah, they saw me. They were, whoa. Kids were leaving.
Oh, my God.
She is not meant to disrobe.
The trays.
No, but it was like that was the only way I could feel comfortable doing it.
Yeah. I had a friend that did one of the baths and... Everyone laughed at her because her skin went so red.
Oh, she was like, that's stupid. Your skin does that.
People have nightmares when that happens. I was nude in public and strangers were laughing.
And pointing at me. And they're speaking in a different language and I don't know what they're saying.
Woo! That's right. Triple R.
The dreamy Sean O'Byrne joins us to talk books. Morning, Sean.
Good morning, good morning.
What have you been reading?
I've been reading Hallie Butler's book, Banal Nightmare, which I did like a lot. I was thinking on the way down here, one way to say what it is, it's a book about the frontiers of alienation, which is a cheery thing to say. Alienation where you really would be working jobs like being a secretary or working in the office of an institution or something like that, and you really do feel that loathing, loathing of all of the ideas about how to do things quickly, how to organise things. And she, more than anybody I've ever read, she gets the feeling of that page after page after page. And I actually wrote this quote down. The New York Review of Books said she's refreshingly merciless, which I did like as a phrase.
Like that.
But what it reminded me of is that, I don't know how to talk about this exactly, but the kind of rising instant loathing you can feel for, say, for example, certain kinds of personal style in people, a hat, certain kinds of sunglasses. I was thinking she does a bit in her book, The New Me, which is about those particular kind of... sleeveless furry vests that a certain kind of middle-aged person ladies
sleeveless
wear.
Furry vests.
Yes, with a kind of faux feather trim.
Yeah. Like a bolero jacket? Yeah, like a bolero with a little jacket?
Longer.
Oh, yeah. Yes, okay, I'm getting it.
And what she will do is she'll keep opening these doors into, so you might think that this is not worth objecting to, but then she kind of leads you further where, so if you're the kind of person that's like, that's your idea of the good, of the luxurious, well, okay, in a way you can think, can please let people wear whatever coats they want, but then you also get further into, no, if that's your idea of the good, you are a problem. This is a problem, right? This is where it gets kind of merciless, right? Towards, and then she kind of keeps going further and further into, there's a good rant about the Oscars in this book, towards something like the Hillary Clinton or the Kamala Harris campaign. Like she keeps going outwards to where, and then connecting to, it kept reminding me of that David Graeber book, Bullshit Jobs, which people might have come across, where he talks about how so much activity in corporations or institutions is this kind of busy work or placeholder activity, which is, literally hundreds of thousands of people doing this work, which is all about just presenting a certain kind of idea of what we can organise. It is bullshit. This is the kind of thing she'll do. It reminded me, I was in the city the other day and I saw in the Telstra building there's an enormous electronic sign saying all in for reconciliation. It's huge in the foyer. They're all in. And I remember thinking, so this is the Hallie Butler feeling where she would look at that with a special kind of loathing. Yeah. She would know what that was and she'd be, you know, sort of rightfully angry about it. She hates
No, this. I think they've fixed it. Right? Big neon sign, we're done.
I think things have been reconciled. Yeah. Now.
It changes people. You just need to do good design.
Like and the gate DMs.
Yes. Mm. Oh, see? So why do people worry so much? Good design and we're done.
So it's misanthropic without turning into a crank or being miserable.
Yes, yes. It gets to something which is like sooner or later some sort of deep, proper criticism of what we've done, where we're up to. But the thing that's so interesting is it also begins to turn into something even more, which is the part of the structure of it is she has this girl called Moddy. Moddy is this bitterly alienated, and she keeps bringing the action of the story. She goes back to her Midwestern town. She starts to meet people she went to school with, and it's sort of you can see that she's the job of the book is to bring her into contact with people who are maybe half alienated but sort of want to agree, to people who really want a stake in the existing system. Like bless people, this woman called Pam, this woman called Kimberly, and they really want whatever position is in front of them. They're working for it desperately. But as the book goes on, you realise that the Moddy character, who we've sort of had sympathy for because she's the most bitterly alienated, and the others are all in some underlying way the same. They all have this self, this idea of the self or the me, which is too large. Me, my feelings, not connected to any idea of maybe your feelings and your identity aren't that important maybe for a while. And at this point, and I wonder what people thought about this, it begins then to come up against this idea, which I know there's been too much of, which is, so this is millennial and this is a group of millennials. And I was talking to people in the bookshop last night about it and it was interesting. Some people were, I don't believe in that category. I think it's been so, it's an attempt at a category which I don't think even exists. But I must say that argument of this book, as far as I could follow it, was no, something has happened. We used to have to participate with other people in some room, and the millennial people were the first generation that in some way didn't have to do that, could curate their own experience to a degree that's really, I guess, unprecedented, and it made a difference. So again, everybody from Moddy, who hates just about everything, to somebody who's sort of alt but, you know, wants some sort of position, to somebody who's all in for a promotion at, bless Telstra, I'm just going to go ahead and say. All of them, though, have a large me that is what keeps wanting more for itself but also is really lonely and keeps trying to call it off. There's some really affecting moments in the book where people say, just tell me what to do, or I'm in a kind of solitary confinement. And I thought it was very moving, and I basically believed what she was telling me, which is, yeah, something's happened to subjectivity, to an idea of the self, which is characteristic of this generation. Characteristic of, I mean, we can all participate, we can all jump in. I'm not saying that anybody older couldn't be doing this as well. And this is the banal nightmare. I just had this, it gives you this vision of these sort of, you know, like flying over the city and seeing hundreds of, or thousands or hundreds of thousands of these sort of engorged me's. It's interesting. Yeah. No book has brought it home to me as much, not even The Graeber, which is sort of about this in a different way. But I don't know, there'd be sociology or serious theory about it, but it just shows what a fiction can do.
Yeah. Is it sustainable? Is that vibe sustainable, or is there a reckoning on the way?
It's. I was thinking it's more a book of sentences and scenes than of arc. So yeah. There's bits of it that are, you maybe slightly wish weren't in the book. But overall, it's enough that she's bringing this stuff to the page and managing to, you know, again, make you go outside and think, okay, how many people do I know are participating in this and how much am I participating in this?
Mm.
People keep saying over and over, but what about my feelings? Like, what about my feelings? Mm. Like, and you get the sense of just how big a change this has been where 40 years ago, the idea that you had to be bored and dissatisfied a lot of the time. And I was reading Guy Rundle's Substack and he was saying, look, the community life, committee life, it used to be just taken for granted, right? And half of what people used to do for community activity, we seem to regard now as just intolerable. and hurt people do.
Yeah. Pay me more if you want me to do it.
Well, no, but also when am I going to be recognised? Enough. But then what's moving is how paranoid and unhappy hurt people get. And that connects all the way through to the old thing that David Foster Wallace used to say, which is, quote, we're really setting ourselves up for a fascism because all of these me's are just desperate to be told what to do. And sooner or later, someone's going to say, okay, that's enough. Do this. I will finally give you something you can obey.
Mm.
So all this luxurious subjectivity just ends up with everybody marching in a column.
Is it funny? Is it a funny book?
Very funny.
Yeah.
I got a big kick out of the, again, with that. I kept thinking of the example of wraparound blue mirrored sunglasses or like as a, I was thinking.
Are those raptor sunnies?
Yeah. Mm. So like, you know, that loathing that can rise in you and then having to realize why and what it is. It's about being 12 or 14 somewhere, being somewhere you desperately don't want to be, having not being able to change your circumstances or the fluffy jackets example of, you know, this primal fear of like they will decide everything and I will never get a chance. That's where the alienation I think is justified.
Mm-hmm.
You know, God knows you've all been in a room and everybody in the room is like, we think this, and you're like, I am going to shoot myself. And she says this, she keeps saying I'm going to put a shotgun in my mouth.
As you say, refreshing to experience judgmentalism in the hands of an expert.
Yes. And the thing that's so daring is it's usually her best rants are against the agreed progressivism. So she's very strong on the Hillary Clinton campaign. She has this whole rant about Ruth Bader Ginsburg being an old egoist who got drunk on her own the public celebration of notorious RGB. Yeah, so the book keeps doing this, keeps breaking into this. Moddy's walking around this Midwestern town just breaking into these sort of self. But again, some of the most affecting material in the book is also coming from Pam or Kim where they so desperately want to attach to an institution, get that promotion, get that role, but even there they want to shine, they want to be recognised in some special way. They want, and there's lots of that kind of language, this role will align with my values. And you do get this idea of kind of like the systemic sort of almost culture-wide or society-wide mistake we're making.
Mm.
Again, our bloated me's.
I mean, a book like this sounds like it could be at risk of being insufferable because of the people are awful.
Yes, and I certainly think there'd be plenty of good reads reviews going, I didn't like anyone, but look, it's a book for anybody who's felt alienated a bit but then also wants to come up against, well, okay. Because the thing it made me think about a lot was, how justified is your alienation? How justified is it? Because usually the move is, okay, I need to call this off. People should be allowed to do some stuff. But the move she makes, which I did think was interesting, was to go both, look, your alienation is a serious criticism of the amount of bullshit, placeholder and bullshit that's going on. How this is like that's supposed to be impossible under capitalism, but capitalism actually is really interested in doing like padding these huge middle class areas around itself, giving people hundreds and hundreds of roles in order to save us all from thinking through. Because her deeper ethical argument is underneath it is what we could be thinking about if we weren't going for the role and also trying to think that I'll shine.
Mm.
Oh, well, that's not going to happen. We had a chance. Yeah, I was going to say.
In terms of design, though, columns are satisfying. So. Yeah.
Right.
What a beautiful place to end.
Happy to line up.
In the
We've got a lot done, I think.
Yeah. No one can accuse us of placeholder activity.
69.
Sean O'Byrne is all in on the new book, Banal Nightmare by Hallie Butler. Beautiful. Thanks very much, Sean.
Thank you.
Triple R.
Thanks for listening to the Best Bits of Breakfasters. Catch us live on Triple R every weekday morning from 6 till 9 a.m. or listen on demand at rrr.org.au or on the Triple R app.
You can get in touch with us via Instagram, Facebook, or the Triple R website.